living in a country, you know, like Canada, within this socioeconomic system, particularly as poor, working, racialized people, we rely on a plethora of state-run programs and services to meet our basic needs. Furthermore, particularly again for those living in poor and racialized communities, the state appears to be behind a number of positive initiatives, community centers, redistribution mechanisms, you know, things like welfare, funding of youth and employment programs, etc. Despite facing the hostility of the police, landlords, the theft from banks and financial systems, these elements of the so-called welfare state reinforce the facade of this system's benevolence and the myth of its necessity. There are, however, spaces in which all these niceties and democratic illusions are done away with, where the oppressive, murderous, miserable nature of the system is truly laid to bear. Reservations like the one the Red Cross had to provide disaster relief for last weekend come to mind, as do to a lesser extent times like the G20 mass arrests and framings 2 summers ago. But at the top of that list are most definitely penitentiaries and detention centers in this country. Some 37,000 men, women, and children are imprisoned at this moment in some phase of the correctional system in Canada, a number that is no doubt set to increase as the federal government pushes through its omnibus crime legislation. In the studio to discuss this is Natasha Bryan and Sasha Carty. Sorry about that. Both are studying social work here at York with a particular focus on prison-related issues. They are also members of Supporting Ourselves While Supporting Our Loved Ones, and you'll have to help me with the pronunciation of that acronym, SoSolo. And organizing an organization for people with incarcerated family members. Thank you both so much for coming on today.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
So to begin, I think it's important to point out that you guys are going to be discussing, I mean, we're going to hopefully be able to run through some of the details of the crime bill and, you know, the conditions and the issues that people are facing in the prison system. I think it's important to point out that your commitment to these issues is not out of some sense of, like, solidarity or from some theoretical basis, but because, like, too many people in our communities, these issues are affecting you both directly and personally.
Mm-hmm.
So as I understand, both of you do have family members who are currently incarcerated. I'm wondering if it would be okay if you guys could maybe relate that experience to listeners and kind of run down why and how you began organizing around that issue.
Sure. I'm going to begin. My name is Natasha, and I have a loved one currently incarcerated in the federal system. He's been in since June of this year, and basically that's how this whole idea for the support group began. So going through this experience, I've been through the provincial system, jails, particularly in the city, in the Don Jail before. But the federal system has a lot of unique qualities that the provincial system doesn't have. So navigating through it has been extremely challenging, and which is the case for, I would say, majority of the people who are faced, and loved ones faced with this predicament of trying to support someone through it. So I suppose this group started from that. So when I first went to the sentencing of my loved one, they are taken away at the point of sentencing, and that's when I guess life changes dramatically. And there was basically nobody there to say this is what you do next, like nobody there to support you emotionally. The financial dynamic of the household then changes for many people, so there are many issues that arise out of the removal of somebody from a home. And from that, I attempted to call around the city and locate a supports and such, and unfortunately I didn't really come up with very much. I was referred to general family counseling, and for me that wasn't quite appropriate because the situation has specific dynamics that work outside of that. So unless you're going through it or you know the system well, I don't think that that would be appropriate, at least not for me. So from there, I began the support group. I said, geez, you know, let me just kind of start something up, grassroots sort of motivated and inspired, and just spread the word, word of mouth, and that's how it all began.
Yep, and my name is Sasha, and as for me, I also have a loved one that's incarcerated in the federal system, and when the process began, there was no support as well. There's no one to talk to, and oftentimes there's a lot of shame knowing someone that's in the system because all the stereotypes that a lot of people share in society, and for those who don't go through this experience, they might not know what it's like, right? And they might have, only thing they know is all the stereotypes that is in society already. So I just found that there was not a lot of resources, and I met with Natasha, and we talked, discussed the group, and we wanted to have a support group and also an action group and a place where people can come and feel safe and also get information on how they can navigate through the system.
For sure.
Because there's really no one to talk to. So that's how it all started.
For sure. Now, I mean, it's obviously impossible to relate the degree of like degradation, deprivation that people face within the time that we have.
Mm-hmm.
But you talked about some of the stereotypes that, that people do have about, you know, people who are incarcerated, the families of people who are incarcerated. Can you, and also I think the myths that people have about Canada, that somehow it's somewhat more benign than the U.S., you know, that somehow we're that much better. Can you kind of run through some of the conditions that people do face in penitentiaries and detention centers in Canada, some of the main issues that groups like SoSolo and other prison support groups are organizing around?
Well, I know, I guess the first thing that comes to mind is in Ontario, when someone is sentenced to a 2 years plus a day, which is a federal sentence, they're then put in a local jail and transported to an assessment center, which is Millhaven Assessment Unit. And the federal majority, I would say, if not all of the federal institutions are located in Kingston, Ontario, which of course poses a large barrier to loved ones of accessing and supporting, because the travel is about 6 hours and it's about $60 in gas to and from. But aside from that, in terms of the inside, when a person goes to Millhaven, their stay is supposed to be somewhere around 60, maybe 90 days. But because of the changes that have already happened with crime bills, for example, the removal of accelerated parole and two for one, the system is now experiencing a backlog already. And this is without the omnibus having gone through yet. So you can imagine some people are staying now in the assessment unit for upward to 6 months. And the conditions in there is that there are two people to a cell, and these people are locked up 23 out of 24 hours a day, basically in isolation, in a cell where when both people are standing, there's no room to maneuver around each other. So this means that primarily the people are forced to remain within their bunks or their sleeping kind of quarters, and you're allowed out 1 hour per day, and that is not in practice often given, the 1 hour. And the 1 hour, the inmate has to choose between going to yard for exercise, doing their laundry, contacting loved ones, and so forth. So, I mean, it's hard to make that decision. And not to mention, because there is 1 hour out, there's a lot of competition for the phone. So a lot of people can't even use the phone. And to compound that is also the fact that the federal system, inmates have to register people on their phone calling list, and it has to be approved first. And a lot of people don't have home phones. And cell phones are generally not so much accepted. Three-way calls are no longer, accepted or considered legal. And so even people who do have landlines, like, for example, myself, incur huge bills.
Yeah.
And that's another part of the way the system benefits, because a bill for a month can be $200-$300 if you're not with sort of a provider. So the conditions are very extreme, and there's a lot of suffering that goes on, especially in terms of mental health.
Yeah.
People who already have mental health issues, of course, they'd be exasperated. People who don't, I think of myself, for example, I kind of think we all do, in a sense, in this society, have some sort of mental
yeah.
health stress or issues. But for those of us who, I guess it's more minimal, I mean, if you think about it, if someone put you in this sort of cage-like setting for 23 out of 24 hours a day, and imagine you're there upward of 6 months, like, how would your mental health be after that, right? And then there's a lot of violence that go on as well within the yard. Like, there have been quite a few deaths that have occurred, a couple of which I've mentioned in the article, and that's only a couple.
In Mill Haven in particular.
In Mill Haven, mm-hmm. and in J Unit, and they often occur in the yard.
Yeah.
And that's just Mill Haven, but there's a lot of other sort of violence and deaths that have occurred in other institutions as well, so...
Right. And to add on to that, with all the issues going on inside, there's no resources or programs inside the prison itself to help to address these issues, right? So you have a whole lot of inmates in one space, a small space together, and you have inmates that have mental issues and other social problems, addiction going on, and there's no services inside to help. Because of the changes to the crime bill, you have more inmates in, and they cannot even access the programs that's in there. Like, you have inmates waiting to go to school mm-hmm. for, like, yeah. 6 months. And a part of the parole requirement is that they look at how the inmates behave inside and the programs that they attend to. But if they don't have the programs in there or if they're not accessible, how can one access these programs to be yeah. able to parole, to come out, to be a better member of society?
For sure. So maybe can we run through some of those changes, like, at this moment, before even this ridiculous bill is passed through? What changes have already been put in place in terms of, you mentioned, the 2-for-1, elimination of that, different in terms of parole and all that? Maybe we can just run through some of the changes that have taken place already.
Okay, so yeah, 2-for-1, which I guess a lot of people in the community know or yeah. refer to as dead time, that's been removed. And I mean, that was also put in place because of the harsh conditions in like holdings, like areas such as the Don Jail.
Yeah.
Where there could be 3 people to a cell, where people have slept on floors, where there are like infestations of rats, bitten, you know what I mean?
So, for sure.
So these things were sort of put in place to kind of balance out the harsh conditions of what are going on. And that's been eliminated. And as well, I was mentioning the accelerated parole, which was available for inmates who were in there who had... committed crimes that were not violent, and they were a first-time federal sentence. And so previously they could be able to apply for accelerated parole, which would be around 1/6 of their sentence, but they'd have to at least have served 6 months. And with this system, they didn't have to go through the parole board as they would at 1/3. It was almost automatically granted. And so that was removed. It kind of swept through the readings in the House of Commons and the Senate and received royal assent fairly quickly. The final 2 readings I was following in the Senate, usually there'd be like a reading, a committee discussion, and then a vote, and it would go on. And sort of because the Governor General was coming to give royal assent to some other bills, they kind of swept through the last 2 readings within that almost, I think if I'm correct, the day that the Governor General was coming. So a lot of the basis for eliminating that were a couple, like 2 in particular, so-called fraudsters who generally, I guess, extorted money from mainly people who have money. So I guess they exercise their voices and the money backing their voices, you know.
Can you explain that a little bit further? What do you mean the 2? Yeah.
Okay, so there were 2 people. Their names were Mr. Earl Jones and Mr. Leon Cordian.
Okay.
And they were convicted of extorting large amounts of money from primarily affluent people.
Mm-hmm.
And these affluent people, of course, you know, rallied. And you know, if affluent people are rallying, they're yes. generally heard a lot more and a lot quicker than, let's say, poor people who yeah. are rallying. So
yeah.
So this happened, and that was a large, that carried a large weight in the basis of, I guess, eliminating the 1/6. And because they wanted these 2 men to continue to stay in for a longer period of time, because without the elimination, they would have been eligible for the 1/6,
yeah.
and they would have gotten out. So now the difference with this eliminating the 1/6 is that usually when bills are passed, they kind of apply from that point on going forward. However, with this bill, it was applied retroactively, meaning that everybody who was already in line for this eligible, let's say, for this accelerated parole was now denied, unless they had already been in the like they were already released in the community, or they had their acceptance letter, let's say, in hand.
Yeah.
I could have been, let's say, maybe, for example, I went to my hearing and I pled guilty on the pretense that I would have the possibility of being out in 1/6. So now I've been in there and I've served my whatever the time is, and in 2 days I'm up for my 1/6. And then this law passes, which means then I don't get the 1/6. So, you know.
Now you're in the position where you pled guilty for that and there's no there's
exactly.
No
and so, you know, and those pretenses, and it means nothing. So that means now I have to wait for my 1/3. Mm. And a big part of this, like I mentioned, was a backlog in the system. So my loved one, for example, who is supposed to be eligible for day parole in December and full, like 1/3 or like full parole, let's say, in February, now has to wait 6 months. From the date of application because of the backlog, just to get a parole date.
As a result of eliminating the 1/6.
Right. Mm. So technically his dates should have been, like I said, December and February, but now he's looking at April, if not later, because of the backlog in the system right now. And like I said, this is just, for example, accelerated parole. So you can imagine with the omnibus bill, if it passes, like the huge amount of bodies that are going to be in these institutions. And if this is a delay now, what is going to happen when more people are incarcerated and for longer periods of time?
Mm-hmm. And there's nothing that's being done to address that issue. It's like, it's going to cause all these problems, but there's nothing in place to address that, you know? So
for sure, for sure. And it almost seems like, coming back a little to what you were mentioning in terms of programs and services, not like there being nothing there, that for people who are incarcerated, the message seems to be that anything that you have, even if they're rights that are guaranteed by the charter or, you know, by international law, that these are somehow privileges. Like, you should be happy and grateful that we even give you that, you know? And if demanding anything else, like, how dare you have that demand of us?
Exactly.
Right. And that's so ironic, in a sense, because, like I mentioned, and Sasha mentioned in this article, sort of people are looking at, well, okay, let's throw away the key. Mm. You know, lock these criminals up and throw away the key. But what people aren't focusing on is the majority of these criminals, right, are going to be returning to society, right? They're going to be living in all of our communities. And so how is that going to look when you've just been going through living conditions that are conducive to mental health, they're violent, that are volatile, that abuse your rights for a prolonged period of times? Like, how is that going to look then when you come from that back out into the community? It's almost setting people up to in a sense, right?
No doubt.
Because they're then, of course, with all the cuts to social services, right, not enough or particularly not maybe sufficient enough supports and services then for people who are transitioning. So where are people left and what's going to happen? And people need to look at this as opposed to just getting swept away with this idea of punishment, right? Like perhaps restorative justice and perhaps, you know, looking at, you know, more housing, you know, for people that come out. Housing is an issue. What happens if you don't have a roof over your head or you have a criminal background now and it's the omnibus bill is looking to make getting pardons more difficult? Like, for example, if you've been an offender like 3 times or if you've had 3 offenses, they're looking at making you ineligible for a pardon. So
it's
then
almost a three strikes rule, like U.S.
Exactly,
US
which is fashioning off of a failed U.S. system. Yeah. I mean, like, we mentioned in the article, California is now sanctioned to release tens of thousands of inmates because of overcrowding, because of economic deficits that this has caused.
And I think maybe one thing to point out would be, like, it's definitely failed in terms of meeting the needs of people, poor, racialized people, and but it's been a success in terms of that socioeconomic system, in terms of, like, you know, free or what someone terms slave labor, right?
That's
that reserve that's been created.
Right, because the inmates, I mean, a lot of inmates do get jobs when they go on the inside. Mm. And these jobs pay anything from a couple of dollars to maybe $5 for a full day's work.
Yeah.
So you can imagine if systems are going to be fashioned off of the U.S. With the private investors, I mean, where can you get labor legally for, you know, $5 a day, right? Like, that creates a huge profit margin for capitalists.
And it all, like, also to point out, inmates have jobs that they're making like maybe $5 or less, but the products that's in the jail, like the things that they need for their basic health, those are the same price that's out here.
Yeah,
so you
canteen.
Can so you can imagine, like, for a soap, it's the same price as out here. It's not like a soap in there is like 10 cents and they're making $5. So you can just imagine how they're surviving.
And this is in Canadian penitentiaries as well.
This is all Canadian, because what Sasha's referring to is that inmates have access to a canteen, and a canteen is where you can purchase items like hygiene items or, you know,
food.
Some food items to supplement, like, I guess, a poor diet on the inside, which is what, you know, another concern in a health-related perspective. But yeah, the inmates have to purchase this money with the canteen. And, A, you know, families can put money in the canteen, but a lot of families are poor. Or a lot of people just don't have that support, period.
Yeah.
So the only other alternative is through working, and then wages go into the canteen because paper money can't be handled within the prison system. And then from the canteen, you can purchase these items that are, like Sasha mentioned, priced at, you know, regular value as they are on the outside. So how can you afford, you know, whatever, $5, you know, shampoo if you make $5 a day? If you're lucky, that's on the higher scale of pay.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, that's another thing too. People with any kind of special diet or people that need like any medication, what are the options there in terms of inside?
I know that, like, when they do, you do see a nurse and you do see health practitioners.
Yeah.
And so if you have dietary needs, like my family member is a vegetarian, they're able to access a vegetarian diet, which, I mean, is kind of a poor version of a vegetarian diet, right? But there's that. There's people whose diet consists of halal. They can access that as well. But again, right, it's like the bare minimum. So I would say it doesn't quite meet, you know, nutritional needs that our bodies require.
Mm-hmm.
No, it doesn't. And also, hearing stories from my loved one, they said they have supper at 3 o'clock. That's when supper is. So if you don't have any money on your canteen, the last time you'll eat is at 3. So you can imagine, these are grown men eating supper at 3 o'clock.
And in addition, they're only given, like, a couple of minutes to basically wolf it all down.
Yeah.
You know? So you have to, like, basically take the food and shove it down your throat and give it back, or else, you know, that's it, right? Too bad for you.
Yeah, and then the question of, you know, violence between inmates. I mean, what do you expect to happen under those conditions? And like you said, people housed together for 23 hours. I mean,
and of course, because people are highly stressed, you know, they're being scrutinized, because especially the assessment unit, people are going through interviews with psychiatrists all the time, with their parole officers, educational testing is done, cognitive testing is done, physical tests are done. So it's like you're sort of a rat in a lab, in a sense. So, I mean, if you have then minimal resources in which to sort of vent your frustrations, which, I mean, you have minimal contact with your loved one because access to a phone is really difficult. And even to visit, you have to get on approved list, which requires you to take two passport-sized photographs of yourself and fill out a large form, and then it has to be approved. So if you don't have outlets to sort of vent your stresses, which are huge, I mean, what's going to happen? Of course, there's going to be a lot increased conflict in that one little period of time when people get out into the yard. Not to mention, I mean, it's very hard to exercise in such a confined space. So there's also, like, a lot of energy built up, and where does that go?
Right. And also for visitors, if you yourself have a criminal charge, you cannot visit. So for those inmates who have family members who have a charge in the past, they won't be having no contact. So.
Wow. Any, like, that even if the charge has been, I guess, any adult charge, you wouldn't be able to
No, you would not be able to.
Wow.
So there are a lot of barriers. I mean, and
for
even from a loved one perspective and visiting, like, I mean, of course, like in anything in life, you get, you know, the nice folks and, you know, that help you out, and then you get... And so with visiting, I mean, you do come in contact with, like, you know, a guard who is helpful and who is nice, right? I don't want to make it look like everybody is, you know, out to whatever. But, I mean, overall, they don't make it a very pleasant experience. There are people that I've seen who, because you have to get an ion scan, which is like a piece of material they wipe on your jewelry or clothing and put in a machine sort of thing that then tests for, I guess, narcotics, traces of narcotics. As well, you can be subjected to searches by dogs where you're lined up in a row and the dog goes back and forth and searches you. And so there have been like many instances where people have went to visit and have no affiliation with narcotics, but the ion scan has come back positive.
Yeah. For some reason, yeah.
For whatever reason. It's a machine, right?
Yeah,
you mean
of
a machine
course.
Can't malfunction yeah. or whatever, right? There are many variables that could cause this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the person visiting their visits could be banned. They could be subjected to strip searches, like in a more extreme case, right?
Yeah.
We've heard of that.
Yeah.
And so then you can also get like bullied. You can sort of be marked, right, when you go to visit, and it make it very difficult for
yeah.
you. And I think that, and even from like hearing from different loved ones or people who've been on the inside who are now on the outside that we communicate with, they and I guess we perceive that to sort of be an attempt to continue to isolate inmates, right?
Yeah.
To increase the isolation. Because as we know, when people are more isolated, they're more susceptible, you know, to abuses, because
yeah.
people feel institutional, particularly like, let's say, institutional abuses, because then people feel that there won't be anybody to stand up for this person, you know, and fight for what's going on in the inside, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even still, one huge problem we often discuss is when there are violations that occur within
by guards or
by
the,
let's
like,
say
yeah,
by staff,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
For example, there are of course in policy procedures you can take to, you know, file a complaint and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But in practice, if you go and do these things, it's
sure.
going to be the person on the inside who suffers.
Yeah.
They're going to go through hell because of this. So it's sort of set up in that way that, you know, people on the inside sort of know they can do whatever they kind of want to do without being held liable, because, you know, the loved ones have this fear of, you know, if they complain, it's going to be taken out on their partner or their son or their whoever
yeah.
who's already going through dire circumstances, which I think is why not a lot, you know, you don't hear a lot of that, and maybe that's why it's continuing. But it's hard, I think, and maybe until loved ones collectively come together, possibly in like a large number, and maybe file some sort of a mass thing,
yeah.
or, you know, that might be a great idea.
Yeah.
That it's going to continue, right? Like, so
you
right,
mean,
and that's
mm-hmm.
why it's important to have groups like Solo, like, to create a safe space for people to come together and to talk about these issues, and also to get information on what they can do to address these issues, because there is no accountability system inside. Right, it's like they're in there and like nobody cares. The guards have all the power to do whatever
yeah.
they want, and a lot of them will let you know that they don't hide anything,
no,
right? Because they have the power to do so. It's similar to how the police and society act,
yeah.
especially in neighborhoods like Jin and Finch. They have the power to treat the youths however they want to treat them, poor families however they want to treat them, because there's no accountability.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and any act in defiance or seeming defiance of that power is crushed without, you know,
exactly.
mercy.
And put people at risk of being further targeted and
yeah.
targeted in worse ways.
Yeah.
So I think that's where the importance of collective organizing comes in. And I think that's a part of what we kind of want to work at in our group is, you know, work towards some social justice, you know, causes and some movements, and, you know, partner more with like-minded organizations,
yeah.
albeit grassroots or, you know, nonprofits that are sort of on a similar mindset.
For sure, for sure.
Because there's, like, as we know, strength and power in numbers, right? So
have there been any cases within, like, the past few years of inmates themselves, like, inside the institutions, any kind of organized or like, campaigns or resistance from within? Like, I know there was something around t-shirts, like they had the Canadian
yeah.
flag or whatever
yes,
upside down with
yes,
bars
yes,
and then
yes.
the Vic Taves himself announced that they took them all away.
Well, that was an interesting
yeah.
actually an interesting point, because There's the Prisoner's Justice Day that happens every year, and that began on the inside, and loved ones and allies supported on the outside by meeting up and organizing, and we did this year, as well as going in front of the Don Jail, and that was pretty powerful. But what you're referring to, the T-shirts, is interesting because in order for the inmates to have had the T-shirts, they had to go through an approval process. Mm-hmm. And so the process was approved. And when they got the T-shirts, you know, they had them, they wore them. And apparently, and this is not obviously firsthand, this is what I've learned, that there was somebody who worked on the inside that was offended by the shirts. And through that one person being offended, it went to the next level, and then the shirts got banned, right? But it's interesting that they were approved.
In the first place.
Right. Yeah, they couldn't just create the... They were approved. Yeah. So they were approved, and then they were just taken away. So...
Yeah. And a lot of times, inmates resist by refusing to go in themselves. Like, there's been a lot of lockdowns, and that's what causes these lockdowns, right? So.
And also fasting. Fasting. I mean, that happens on the Prisoner's Justice Day. But it also happens, you know.
Like individual acts of resistance.
Right, individual acts of resistance.
And, stuff, right?
And I know there was also some resistance at Millhaven. I think it was in the assessment unit because they were trying to, I think, eliminate access to red bags, which is, I think, when they come into the institution, they have certain, like, personal belongings in the red bags, maybe a book, maybe some money for a canteen or whatever. And I think they were trying to sort of stop access to that. And then in the yard, there was sort of a rumble of, you know, something going on, like a resistance or, I don't know, protest or whatever. But that was dismantled. But that was another sort of... but a lot of these things I don't think you hear about too much. But there's a lot of different ways to resist. And also... Another way of resistance could be inmates, like, writing externally. That could be letters to, you know, local and grassroots papers, like for example, Basics. Or, you know, through poetry, through participating in academic research around, you know, prison issues. So I think there's many different ways of resistance.
Definitely. And and groups like Soul Solo Functioning, that's the bridge between those, so that you know, people in the community know about what's going on inside, and when there is that potential for some kind of organized, you know, campaign or action, that can be defended.
Yeah, because this is an issue that affects everyone, not just the inmates and the loved ones. Because as Natasha said, they are going to come out one day. And we're going to have to, you know, deal with these people. Like, so it's an issue that affects us all.
And in addition, right, we look at the costs of, let's say, implementing the omnibus bill, or the costs involved in the changes to legislation. But I think what people also need to look at is the sort of secondary costs as a result of people being incarcerated. And that could be, let's say, for example... a family consisting of whatever, a husband and wife and children, let's just say, right? And the let's say the husband is incarcerated, and he was the breadwinner for the family. So now the perpetualization of the feminization of poverty will then continue, right? Because the woman is now left with, how do I pay my rent? Like, how do I buy clothes for my children? And often people have to resort to social assistance. So people aren't looking at these kind of costs. And as well, on the flip side, for women who are incarcerated, there's also the issue of children. Because when men are incarcerated, for the most part, childcare tends to be incurred by the woman who's the parent of the child, first and foremost. But when women are incarcerated, the care of the children tend to either be taken on mainly by the woman's parents or the grandparents of the child. But then there's also a lot of intervention with CAS. So in addition to the basic fundamental costs of these bills, there's also a lot of costs, like, you know, through being sort of left behind as a result of incarceration. Families and loved ones have to survive still, and without that person, so it changes lives, like, in a major way.
For sure. Unfortunately, I just looked at the time, we're running out. I want to ask a lot more, like, even make the connection between now this bill being implemented and all the cuts to you know, social services and that, you know, when we look at the, as you were mentioning, the secondary impacts of incarceration on the community, but also what causes and what leads people to illicit means of survival in the first place,
right.
In terms of now this program of austerity. But maybe we can we'll save that for another show.
Sure.
But I definitely want to end off just on the note, if there are any families that are listening who do have someone or any individual who has somebody on the inside that they know, how can they contact you guys? How can they get more involved in this process?
Well, definitely. We more than welcome people who are supporting a loved one who is incarcerated provincially or federally. And that doesn't have to mean you're related by blood. It could mean that you're a friend. It could mean that you're a partner. Yeah. It could mean a lot of things. Just a loved one without, you know, labels, I guess. You can contact us by email at sosolo, it's sosolo411@gmail.com. If you'd like some more more information, I'm getting tongue-tied. Mm-hmm. And we have monthly meetups where we meet up, we exchange information, we, you know, laugh together, we cry together, we plan social movements together.
Yeah.
So it's very, like, informally therapeutic. And we have a lot of good information because there are people in the group who have been going through this for quite a long time, let's say supporting people who are serving life sentences. Okay. So there's a lot of resources from within the group. And as well, we've been connecting with a lot of other external people who are willing to share the information, whether that's like legal education. There's been a couple of lawyers willing to provide information which will help with costs, you know, because the costs of going through the legal process are huge. We also want to branch into doing some court support so if there are people out there who are supporting someone who are, let's say, going to a sentencing hearing where that person's going to be taken away from them and gone into the system. If somebody doesn't have anybody or needs somebody, we're trying to arrange peer support to accompany that person because it's extremely emotional and extremely impacting. So then that peer support person has already been through it and can be there after the person's taken away to pass along information as to what to do next, and as well just to be like a shoulder, you know, just a shoulder and some emotional support. So you have any?
I feel if you know anyone, or maybe you yourself don't have anyone that's incarcerated, but if you know anyone that does, just share that information with them, and so that they can come and have a safe space to talk about their experience and not be judged, because it's very hard to find a group or find someone that you can tell about this. I mean, you can't just go to work and say, oh, my loved one is in jail for, you know, like there's just a lot of issues with that. So, share the information so that together as a group we can make changes, because that needs to be made now.
And again, just to let you know, it's sosolo, S-O-S-O-L-O, 411@gmail.com. So hit us up and we'll respond and, you know, take it from there.
Definitely. And as you guys mentioned, there's going to be an article in the next issue that you two are writing in the next issue of Basics. And we'll definitely hopefully have a more long-lasting relationship between the two organizations after this. So we'll have all that contact information up on the site for the next issue.
Yeah, that'd be great. We'd love to, you know, continuing spreading the word, because I think it's really important, and unfortunately it's not talked about enough as to the human cost to this issue and what really this is going to entail in terms of, like, lived experience versus just, you know, being put on paper.
And also, Natasha gave you guys the website. I'm going to leave you with the phone number. It's 647-247-9849. That's 647-247-9849. So give us a call or send us an email.
Definitely. Sasha and Natasha, thank you so much for coming on today. That's it, unfortunately, for Radio Basics today. We will be back next week, and definitely check out the issue of the paper. It should be coming out by the end of this week, particularly that article that's going to be written by Natasha and Sasha about the Omnibus Crime Bill and, as you mentioned, the human cost of incarceration in this country. Thank you.
Can we say thank you so much? We want to say thank you so much to Basics and, of course, to you for having us here. We really appreciate this opportunity to come and talk about this issue. So thank you. And
we'll definitely continue to follow up on it.
Definitely.
In future shows. Wonderful experience. And articles, for sure.
You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM. Broadcasting at 158 watts at 105.5 FM. On the World Wide Web at CHRY.FM. And on the Rogers Digital Network, channel 945.